In his new novel, The Finkler Question, British author Howard Jacobson introduces us to a character named Julian Treslove. He's a Gentile who happens to have a strange obsession with Jews and Jewishness, and a particular Jew named Sam Finkler.
Before he met Finkler, Treslove had never met a Jew, not knowingly at least. He supposed a Jew would be like the word Jew, small and dark and beetling, a secret person.
But not Sam Finkler. To the contrary, he's big in body and in character. Treslove is entranced, jealous, really, of his friend's Jewishness. He imagines that Jews live more deeply, more passionately. Finkler, on the other hand, takes an opposite view. He's a vocal opponent of the State of Israel, a prism through which he can escape his Jewishness. Howard Jacobson's comic novel, you might call it bitterly comic, won this year's Man Booker Prize. It's the highest literary award for fiction in Britain. And when I spoke with Howard Jacobson recently, he described his characters, Finkler and Treslove, and the differences between being Jewish in Britain and America.
The whole point of having Treslove was to make some comedy out of how Jewishness looks to somebody who isn't a Jew. I mean, we often have how Jewishness looks to somebody who isn't a Jew and who hates Jews. And in a book where there is some of that, I wanted the opposite too. I wanted how does Jewishness look to somebody who really adores Jews and so exaggerates, you know, their more lovable qualities.
Sam Finkler is a pop philosopher. He's a well-known radio personality in Britain. He shows people how Schopenhauer could help people with their love lives or Hegel with their holiday arrangements. And as you say, he's not just critical of Israel. He happens to hate everything about the Jewish state. I mean, he goes, as you write, so far to join this group of British Jews who call themselves a shame. They call for boycotts against the state and so on. I mean, is he an archetype? Is Sam Finkler an anomaly in modern Britain?
No, I mean, there are a lot of Sam Finklers, which is why I invented him. I invented him out of what I felt I saw. They would, of course, deny it. But there is a virulence at the moment about Israel in England. When I was writing this novel, and this was one of the impulses behind the writing of the novel, to investigate this, many Jews that I knew, rational, calm Jews, were truly wondering whether England was going to go on being the safe haven for them that it's been for a long time. Not the kind of safe haven America is for Jews, where a Jew in America feels he's absolutely of the American culture and plays his part in the founding of and the moulding of and the recreation of American culture. Slightly more distant. Distant but safe, it seemed, until the last few years, when it might not be that it's unsafe on the streets, though it has been unsafe on the streets for some, when things get particularly hot in the Middle East, during the blockade, the Gaza blockade and so on. But even when that's not the case, it's just the temperature of the newspapers. It can be very wearing to Jewish nerves to have this bombardment all the time.
Is it possible that Sam Finkler, who of course is the Finkler in the Finkler Question, and the real Jewish opponents of Israel in Britain, people like him, are simply sort of exercising a kind of tough love approach? Or do you see something else happening?
Well, some are, but Finkler isn't. I mean, I could have, and there are some people who flit in and out of the book who are. And some would say, and I think it's a very, very fair thing to say, that to be a friend of Israel is to be critical of Israel. But there's something else about Finkler that I go for in this book and that accounts for some of the book's comic anger at this stage, and that's the whole business of being ashamed. What annoys me about that is not their politics, but the idea that what's happening somewhere else is about them. It's the vanity of it. It's the egoism. It's the parading of their it's the wearing their hearts on their sleeve. It's this carnival of conscience that I make fun of in the book. Not the political position at all, which in some cases is perfectly reasonable. It's the fact that, you know, I feel this. I feel this in my heart. It's my story. It's about me.
I'm speaking with British novelist Howard Jacobson. His latest book is called The Finkler Question. It was recently awarded Britain's Man Booker Prize for fiction. Howard Jacobson, I read that you were not raised in a particularly observant Jewish home. You barely stepped into a synagogue, if I have that correct.
Yes, that's correct.
And I gather your intention was never to write about the Anglo-Jewish experience. It just sort of ended up that way in many of your novels. Do you think that you will sort of step away from that from that theme?
Well, I keep trying to. This book surprised me because I thought... I wrote a novel once called The Mighty Waltzer, which is about playing table tennis, actually. It's about being Jewish and being playing table tennis. And then I wrote a novel called Kaluki Nights, which was intensely Jewish. It had the word Jew on every line. It was a novel about being obsessed with being Jew. I mean, every line was Jew, 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 joke, 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 why. Obsession was its subject. And I thought that was that. And then somehow this novel came along, and it took me by surprise too. But you're right to have said that I never began as thinking of myself as a Jewish writer at all. It astonished my family and my friends when I wrote about Jews. I never really knew very much about it. I'm still a bit of a Treslov, actually. This could be where Treslov comes from. I'm still a bit of a Gentile looking with my nose pressed in against the window of Jewishness, thinking, how fantastic, what great jokes they make. Look how wild they are. Look how warm they are. Look how deeply they love. And so I am a touch like that still.
That's British novelist Howard Jacobson. His latest book, The Finkler Question, was recently awarded Britain's Man Booker Prize for Fiction. Howard Jacobson, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And you can hear Howard Jacobson read more from his novel at npr.org.
One of the great experiences of Paris is browsing the booksellers along the banks of the Seine. Many of the booksellers are now selling tourist souvenirs, which they say brings in more money than the books. In an effort to protect a cherished tradition, City Hall is cracking down on license holders, and Eleanor Beardsley sends us this report from Paris.
If you've ever strolled along the Seine River, you've surely walked past the booksellers and their stalls. Known as bouquinistes, these often crusty old characters sell old books, rare posters, and historic memorabilia out of green wooden boxes mounted on the walls alongside the river. But increasingly, the bouquinistes are forced to peddle less lofty merchandise to make ends meet. Amongst the literature at André Paul's stall are Eiffel Tower keychains and drink coasters printed with impressionist scenes.
Just because we're in the business of selling culture doesn't mean we shouldn't be able to make a living at it. It's hard work being out here in the weather and with the traffic noise. So sometimes we have to compromise and sell a few trinkets along with our books.
There are about 250 bouquinistes along the Seine. Each has four boxes loaned to them for free by the city of Paris. In exchange, bouquinistes are allowed to fill only one box with tourist mementos. Paris City Hall recently launched a competition to attract new bouquinistes to stalls that had lain empty. About 300 candidates applied for 30 slots. Lynn Cohen-Solel, deputy mayor in charge of commerce, explains why it's so important to find the right candidates.
For Paris, it's something very important to have real professional people as bouquinists and not only people coming there just to make money.
Many bouquinists are former professors or journalists and often specialize in a certain genre. Alain Huchet sells cookbooks and old menus. He pulls out a restaurant menu from a dinner held in 1871 during the Prussian siege of Paris when hundreds of people starved to death.
They ate the zoo animals, including the last elephant. They also ate rats and cats. And here are some beans made with dog meat.
The first bouquinist in Paris opened his stall in the 1600s. In 1802, Napoleon Bonaparte placed them on the banks of the Seine and began to regulate the trade. Today, 3.5 miles of the riverbank are decorated with the watertight, dark green boxes. As Deputy Mayor Cohen-Solel puts it, Paris is the only city whose river runs through two bookshelves. Jean-Pierre Mathias is a 25-year veteran of the bouquinistes trade. He is opening his stalls for the day's business. He holds a prestigious spot across from France's great literary institution, the Académie Française. Mathias's wife, who is also a bouquiniste, has a place in the more touristy section near Notre Dame Cathedral, he says. But the couple manages to make a living at it and raise two small children. Mathias says you can't compromise on your principles, though.
Les Chinois disent, bon, si y a quelque chose qui se vend, on a qu'à le copier.
Mass tourism means you get the same thing everywhere, and we booksellers are suffering from an invasion of Chinese copies. But I'm here to raise the cultural level and to meet the demands of people who are looking for something specific.
Matias says everything he sells is original. He doesn't offer plastic miniature reproductions of the Moulin Rouge like some of his neighbors.
Ça, c'est Moulin Rouge, mais ça, c'est l'époque.
But he does have a complete set of circa 1950 original programs from the Moulin Rouge nightclub. I'm one of the only ones to have the entire collection, he says. They're very rare. For NPR News, I'm Eleanor Beardsley in Paris.
It's the only program where you can hear about booksellers, a famous river, and dog meat, all in the same story. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Think about some phrases here. Going places, a sense of place, being stuck in place. These are all themes of new books suggested for holiday giving by some independent booksellers around the country. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg, who's never stuck in place, puts their suggestions in place right now.
Readers and writers are usually word lovers. Phil Cousineau has put together definitions and stories about some favorite words in his book, Word Catcher. Daniel Golden at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee says there are loads of word collections, but he read this one cover to cover.
I thought I was just going to dip into it, and then I thought I don't really want to miss any of these words.
Like the Irish word crack, spelled C-R-A-I-C.
A good time, where the action is, the real thing. Where's the crack? It's asked in pubs, streets, schools, after mass, before leave-taking, meaning where's the fun, the good time, the best people, the nightlife?
A good time can mean going places. Lucia Silva of Portrait of a Bookstore in Studio City, California, says Alain de Botton's book, A Week at the Airport, tracks goings and comings. The author was invited to be writer-in-residence at London's Heathrow Airport, live there for a week, sit at a desk in the middle of the departure hall observing and, amazingly, writing. This excerpt about families leaving for vacation.
He had booked the trip in the expectation of being able to enjoy his children, his wife, the Mediterranean, some spanakopita, and the attic skies. But it was evident that he would be forced to apprehend all of these through the distorting filter of his own being, with its debilitating levels of fear, anxiety, and wayward desire. British Airways did, it was true, maintain a desk manned by some unusually personable employees and adorned with the message, "We are here to help." But the staff shied away from existential issues, seeming to restrict their insights to matters relating to transit time and the location of the nearest toilets.
Getting someplace, living someplace, losing someplace. Another Lucia Silva choice is about all of that, a gorgeous work, she says, full of longing for what once was. Before Hurricane Katrina, the book is Where We Know, New Orleans as Home, edited by David Rutledge.
This is a collection of essays from people who call New Orleans home and some who stayed to rebuild their lives. And it cuts past that romantic veneer, but still recognizes these magical, singular things about such an iconic city.
A mosaic of impressions from writers, teachers, workers.
It feels to me like a memoir about someone you wish you'd known.
The narrator of Howard Norman's novel, What Is Left the Daughter, wishes he had known his daughter better. On her 21st birthday, he writes her a letter. Rona Brinley at the Bookmark in Neptune Beach, Florida, is a great Howard Norman fan.
He starts every one of his book with some confession of a wrongdoing. And so if that doesn't hook you, I don't know what will.
In What Is Left the Daughter, the confession is about something from the father's childhood. In Halifax, Nova Scotia, during World War II, a German student moves into town and thereby hangs the tale. Howard Norman's themes are love, revenge, and xenophobia.
And those are the same issues that we face today. There's nothing wrong with this student. He hasn't done anything. And yet there's just this inordinate fear and concern that he is going to do something just because he's German and it's World War II.
Hooked, Rona Brinley was. She also likes Elizabeth Tova Bailey's fascinatingly titled The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. A gem, Rona says.
It's no bigger almost than a 5x7 file card, a tiny little book that really proves that wonderful things do come in small packages.
A bedridden woman is given a plant. On the plant, a snail. A snail, she thinks, and then becomes mesmerized by it.
The snail is really going through life at the same pace that she is because she can't get out of bed and she can't do anything.
Ultimately, says Rona, the snail becomes a companion, a comfort, a lesson in life. So, the snail lady is stuck in place. Isabella, the purple-haired heroine of Jennifer Fosbury's children's book, is trying out places and people she can be. The book is called My Name Is Not Isabella.
In the morning, her mother says, you know, good morning, Isabella. And she goes, I'm not Isabella. Well, who are you? And she's different people as the day goes on.
She's astronaut Sally Ride, or at breakfast, sharpshooter Annie Oakley.
When she gets on the bus, she's Rosa Parks. When she comes home to do her homework, she's very smart. She's Marie Curie to do her homework.
All of us need role models. Rona thinks Isabellas are beauts.
At the end, of course, she's Isabella again, and she's going to go to sleep and she's going to dream about who she can be tomorrow.
My Name Is Not Isabella, a treat for readers age 4 to 8. Finally, more from Phil Cousineau's Word Catcher, just because it's fun. Bookseller Daniel Golden wants us to wrap up with kabosh, another Irish word. Who knew?
I love that word.
I do, too. I like to use it once a week,
which
means I have to squelch something. Kabosh, to put a lid on it, to put a stop to squelch. To take the lid off the mystery of this old Gaelic word, we need to hop across the pond and revisit the Irish funeral practice of placing a kabosh, a black cap, on the deceased, a solemn form of saying farewell. Across the Irish Sea, in England and on the continent, a black cap was worn by judges passing a death sentence. Thus, to put the kabosh on someone is to declare them as good as dead.
Excellent. Okay, did you have one more that you want to do?
I'm very excited to mention borborygmus, but...
I'm excited to hear it.
Borborygmus are stomach growls, the rumble in the jungle of your tummy. Our word descends from the Greek borborygmus, from borborygmus, rumble, no kidding, the burbling sounds issuing forth from your intestinal passing of gas. This is a great word to pull out around the Thanksgiving table when the snarls and growls coming from the bowels of your guests threaten to drown out the cheers and jeers coming from the football game on television.
Bon appetit, and thanks to all our independent booksellers whetting your appetite for a happy holiday season. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has a wish for this holiday season, that everyone read a terrific book, and she has some to recommend. She says she doesn't care whether you read the books on her 2010 Best of the Year list electronically or the old-fashioned way.
Sometimes there is justice in the world. That was my first thought when I heard that Patti Smith had won the National Book Award this fall for her glorious memoir, Just Kids, which has just come out in paperback. Smith wrote the book to honor Robert Mapplethorpe, her youthful partner in love, art, and ambition. But Just Kids is also a celebration of the frayed beauty of New York City in its so-called years of decline, the late 1960s into the 70s. Early in her memoir, Smith likens herself to the iconic Audrey Hepburn, a young girl full of pure yearning. Smith says that she and the more brooding Mapplethorpe were a curious mix of Funny Face and Faust. Another standout work of nonfiction this year also explores a famous relationship that defied convention. Hazel Rowley's biography of the marriage of Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, called simply Franklin and Eleanor. Rowley charts the evolution of the Roosevelt Union from a standard-issue high-society alliance to something we don't even have a label for. Maybe semi-open marriage comes closest. Speaking of conformity and rebellion, Rebecca Traister's so very smart and lively book about the 2008 presidential campaign, called Big Girls Don't Cry, teases out how our reigning cultural narratives about femininity and playing nice came to wield so much power during the campaign and finally in the voting booth. For all its daring allure, early 20th century American detective fiction pretty much played by the rules when it came to the standard issue look of its detective heroes. Sam Spade and company were white straight males who were quick to pull the trigger on any characters who were different. One enormously popular detective hero, however, who smashed the stereotype was Charlie Chan, the subject of a fascinating mishmash of a book also called Charlie Chan by Chinese-born scholar Yunta Huang. In the late 19th century, ordinary people, Mill girls, garment workers, and miners embraced the revolutionary idea that by joining together, they might better their lives. Philip Dre's spectacular narrative history of the American labor movement, called There Is Power in a Union, reads like a novel, filled with dramatic acts of barbarism and bravery. This nonfiction Best of the Year list has turned out to be composed of stories and people who refuse to play by the rules, so I'll end it with two other out-of-the-box mentions. First, Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken, the unforgettable and, yes, inspirational World War II tale of Louis Zamperini, Olympic athlete and prisoner of war. Zamperini's story puts to shame all of us these days who use the word survivor casually. Second, two books by Gabrielle Burton, a writer now in her 70s, whose near-lifelong obsession with Tamsin Donner, the wife of the leader of the notorious Donner Party, inspired her to write a fabulous on-the-road feminist memoir called Searching for Tamsin Donner, as well as an evocative recreation of Tamsin's lost journal called Impatient with Desire. Since we're on to fiction now, here are my top picks. Certainly Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, a novel about a marriage, deserved all of its applause, despite the literary spitball fight over Franzen's demigod status. My personal favorite novel of the year was Lionel Shriver's So Much for That, a moving black comedy about the emotional and financial cost of health care in America. I also admired David Mitchell's beautiful novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, which traces the life of its title character, who starts working in 1799 on a small European outpost in the harbor of Nagasaki, Japan. Finally, Gary Steingart's novel, Super Sad True Love Story, moves at warp speed, telling a dystopian but comic story about a future where books are derided as objects that smell like wet socks. I can never close out a literary year without giving a nod to mystery fiction. The late Stieg Larsson's last Lisbeth Salander novel, The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, deservedly overpowered all. But this was the year I also belatedly discovered suspense writer Tana French. French's police procedurals about the Dublin murder squad, including this year's Faithful Place, are brilliantly dark and moody. I want to end by doffing my hat not to a book, but to an independent bookseller and small press publisher. David Thompson was known throughout the mystery world. He died suddenly this year at 38. David introduced me to the wonders of noir writers like Reed Farrell Coleman, Daniel Woodrell, and Martin Limon. His legacy is a reminder to all of us who love books that, as someone once said about the late critic Irving Howe, enthusiasm is not the enemy of the intellect.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find links to all the books on her Best of the Year list, along with links to excerpts of those books and Maureen's original reviews of some of those books, on our website, freshair.npr.org.
If celebrity tell-all books are the junk food of the literary world, author Susan Jane Gilman has been on a binge this season. Her favorites may not be the most high-minded additions to your bookshelf, but they could be the most fun you've had reading all year. Here's Susan Jane Gilman with a year-end wrap-up of our series, My Guilty Pleasure, where authors talk about books they're embarrassed to admit they love.
I stayed up for 2 days with Keith Richards, took a bath with Chelsea Handler, and snuggled with Jenny McCarthy. Just last week, I slept with Rick Springfield. I've been indulging my guiltiest pleasure, celebrity tell-all books. What can I say? I generally review hard-hitting nonfiction. But sometimes, so sue me, I just want to read about famous people's bad plastic surgery and drug habits. This year's Confession Fest began with that fabulous wicked wit of the East, comedian Chelsea Handler. Her latest book, Chelsea, Chelsea, Bang Bang, relates her madcap antics during third grade vacations and family powwows. Some of Chelsea Bang Bang is perversely funny. Other times, well, her book is like stand-up. Your enjoyment depends a lot upon your mood and how many martinis you've just consumed. Next up, comedian Jenny McCarthy, famous for being both a Playboy playmate and autism activist. Her new book, titled Love, Lust, and Faking It, is like spending an afternoon with your best friend, a copy of Cosmo, and a low-fat milkshake. McCarthy confides personal stories of heartbreak and humiliation, which are truly affecting, but padded with Twitter surveys, pop psychology, and bedroom horoscopes. Total junk food. Which brings me to Rick Springfield, pop singer, soap star, 80s heartthrob. His memoir, Late, Late at Night, is like binge drinking. You know it's a terrible idea. It leaves a bad taste in your mouth almost immediately, but it's addictive and you just can't put it down. His book attempts naked honesty about his roller coaster career, marriage, depression, and sex addiction. If that's not enough, there are plenty of beefcakey photos. Springfield is 61 and looks 38. There's loads of bad behavior and contrition, but little real wisdom. Which is a shame, because there's powerful material here. At 17, Springfield attempted suicide. In 1968, he saw action in Vietnam as an Australian entertaining the troops. This should be riveting, but somehow winds up glib. But what did I expect? Profundity? Well, enter Keith Richards and his memoir, Life. Granted, I'm a huge Rolling Stones fan. Richards could cough up a hairball and I'd listen. Still, his book is surprising. While it opens with a drug bust, ultimately, life isn't about partying like a rock star, but working like one. Richards goes on for pages about his craft and practicing blues riffs and about how he removed a guitar string to create a raunchier sound. The musical obsessions that have compelled him to keep playing for over 50 years seem to get more ink in the end than his dish about lovers, drugs, or Mick Jagger. Relentless, impassioned, and oddly humble, Richards isn't unconscious in the least. He tells his epic rock and roll life like it is, with salt and candor, but no apologies. This is a pleasure to read, and there's nothing guilty about it.
Susan Jane Gilman is a writer of both fact and fiction. Her latest book is a memoir called Undress Me in the Temple of Heaven. For more on Susan Jane Gilman's recommendations, plus year-end best-of lists from other NPR critics, go to npr.org.
My love.